I hope the week is passing swiftly and profitably for you, as our week is quickly coming to pass. And I hope that something is being said and done to encourage you as you make your journey toward heaven, that something is being said that encourages you, that makes you want to live more faithful, more dedicated, more devoted in the future than you have in the past. The two topics that remain are on the screen before you, and that is, we'll be talking tomorrow evening about the conversion of the 3,000. It's a study from Acts chapter 2, and we'll be talking about the entire chapter, and we'll work our way through that chapter and talk about the conversion of the 3,000. What were they told, and what did they do, and what did they become? Those questions will be answered tomorrow evening. And then on Friday evening, it's a study from Ephesians chapter 4, 5, and 6. And that is the Christian's walk, as we talk about, don't stop, keep walking. So I encourage you now to get your Bible, and let's turn to Genesis chapter 37. In Genesis chapter 37 and in verse 3, we are introduced to Joseph as the favored son of Jacob. The text says that now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children. And that's how we're introduced to him. He's a young man, and he is his favored son. Well, a little later in the text, the story goes on that because of that, his brothers envied him, verse 11. Verse 18 says they would have killed him, but Reuben stopped him from that. You remember that story? And consequently, what they did, according to verse 28, is they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Now drop down to verse 36. In verse 36, the Midianites sold him to Potiphar in Egypt. So now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guard. And so a lot happened in chapter 37. We're introduced to him in verse 3. By the time we get to the end of the chapter, he's been sold by his brothers, and then those who bought him have sold him now to Potiphar. And he's been sold in Egypt, and that's how he got there. So let's skip chapter 38 and go to chapter 39, and I want us to look at verses 1 to 6 now. Genesis 39, 1 to 6, he rose in power, and he brought blessings to Potiphar's household. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. And so Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. And he made him overseer of his house. And all that he had, he put in his hand. And so it was from time to time that he made him overseer of his house. And all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand and did not know what he had except the bread that he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. All right, what we learned from that, verses 1 to 6, was that when Joseph came to the household of Potiphar, it was because of Joseph that Potiphar was blessed. And God blessed all that he had, put his hand to. So he rose in power and he rose in blessings. And he brought blessing to the household of Potiphar. Now, beginning at verse 7 is where our story begins. Beginning at verse 7, Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. And that's where our focal point is in our study tonight. So tonight I want to talk about the seduction of Joseph. And I want us to read beginning at verse 7. And I want us to go down through verse 23, or at least a portion of the way. We'll finally get to the end of the chapter before we get through. But I want to start at verse 7 and reread the story for us, and so that we come back and then make some application thereof. And so let's watch for three things. I want you to see what she did. I want you to notice what he did. And then I want you to notice the results. And we'll talk about all of that as we unfold in a few moments. Let's begin at verse 7 down the tree. It came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in the house and has committed all that he has into my hand. And there was no one greater in the house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. And it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work that none of the men of the house was inside. And she caught him by the garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand, and he fled, and he ran outside. And so it was that when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called the men of the house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought in to us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened that when he heard, I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me, and he fled, and he went outside." And so she kept the garment with her until her master came home. And then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought in to us came in to me to mock me. And so it happened as I lifted up my voice and I cried out, that he left his garment with me, and he fled outside." And we'll stop there and we'll continue that reading in a few moments. But here's what I want you to notice now. That in the seduction of Joseph, there are three things that we just read about. I want you to notice that she seduced him. It wasn't the other way around. Secondly, I want you to notice that he resisted her. And thirdly, there were some results that followed because of that. She seduced him, he resisted her, and there were some results that followed. And those are the three things we want to talk about tonight. Let's start with this. I want you to notice with me tonight that the temptation was strong. And I want to paint a picture before you just how strong that temptation was. We may sometimes think about Joseph, that Joseph was tempted, but Joseph was the strong man and he could easily resist because really it was easy to resist against this kind of temptation. But I want you to see that this temptation was strong, and I mean it was strong. How was it strong? Well, first of all, let's consider this. The temptation was strong when you consider his youth. You consider how young that he was. How young was he? Well, when we were introduced to him in Genesis chapter 37, and I want you to notice in verse 2 that he was 17 years of age. Quite a young man, wasn't he? Wasn't too long before this thing began to happen, and when he was then cast into prison, that's where we leave him. We hadn't read that part yet. We'll get to that at the end of chapter 39. He was cast into prison. But when we get to chapter 41 in verse 46, that he was 30 years old when he got out of prison. Verse 1 said he'd been there for 2 years. So that tells me then that he was somewhere between the ages of about 18 and 28 years of age. You stop and think about this. He wasn't an old man. He wasn't even a middle-aged man. He's a man that was in the prime of his youth. And you're thinking about a time period when perhaps the desires would have been the strongest in the young man. The Bible warns about youthful lust. Paul warned young Timothy, flee youthful lust. You know what that tells me? There are certain temptations that come with every age. But there are certain kinds of temptation that are more peculiar to the younger age. There are lusts that are peculiar to the youth, he said. And so he said, flee youthful lusts. This would have been a time when perhaps that desire would have been at the strongest. The Apostle Paul would say in 1 Corinthians 7 and in verse 9 that one ought to, he said, it's better to marry than to burn with desire. Perhaps that was a time when this would have been at the strongest desire. And you consider how young he was. And there's something very practical I learned from that. And that is in a day and time when we're ready to cast our young people aside as being inferior to the day of our generation. That as it was in the days of Joseph, there are young people who have faith and they have principle and will still stand just like Joseph stood. Here is an example of a person of faith, a person of strength, and a person of character that indeed stood. But I'm trying to paint before you the picture how strong the temptation was. How do you know it was strong? I know it was strong when you consider his youth. But secondly, I know it was strong because it was she that solicited him. It was not he seducing her. She was the one that solicited him. I want you to notice with me at verse 7. She cast longing eyes at him. Have you read that at verse 7? Look back at Genesis 39 and in verse 7. Came to pass these things, after these things that the master... A wife began to cast longing eyes on Joseph. She cast longing eyes on Joseph. The New American Standard translates that, she looked with desire at Joseph. The Living Bible paraphrase said, she began making eyes at Joseph. You see, she can say more with her eyes than she can with her tongue. In Proverbs 6 and in verse 25, nor let her allure you. This is, by the way, talking about the harlot. Remember Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, those three chapters. Nor let her allure you with her eyelids. That says she can say more with her eyes than she can say with her tongue. She doesn't have to say a word. She can just look at him in a certain way that says, I have desires for you. She can look at him in a certain way and send a sensual message to him. She began casting longing eyes at him. She began making eyes at him. She didn't even have to say a word to him. She didn't have to say one word. Or it could be, as some commentators suggest, that it may not mean that she was casting longing eyes in the sense of making eyes, but that she cast her eyes upon him, and that is, she set her eye on him as a target. I'm going to seduce him. He's the one I'm going to break down. He's the one that's going to succumb to my pressures. And either way, she was seducing him. Oh, his temptation was strong, wasn't it? When you consider how young the man was, 17 to 28 years of age, and consider the fact that she was seducing and soliciting him. But thirdly, his temptation was strong when you consider that she told him how far she was willing to go. When she told him how far she was willing to go, she was not flirting and toying only to turn out to be a tease. There may be occasions where the young lady, she begins to make eyes and she begins to cast longing eyes and she flirts and she toys only when he begins to realize, when she begins to realize that he's coming on to her, that she says, oh, no, I'm not interested in going that far. That wasn't the case with Potiphar's wife. Here's what she said. Notice what she said at verse 7. She said, come lie with me. Here's what I'm willing to do. Here's how far I'm willing to go. And I'm here tonight to tell you there were very few young men in Egypt that could have resisted that kind of pressure. Very few young men in the age of 17 to 28 years of age, when a woman began to seduce him and makes longing eyes and begins to say, here's how far I'm willing to go, they could have said, no, I'm not interested in that. Oh, the temptation was strong, wasn't it? Look at how young he was. Look at the fact that she was seducing him, and thirdly, that she told him, here's how far I'm willing to go. What else tells you how strong it was? I want you to consider with me the repetition thereof. The repetition of it. I want to suggest to you that resistance at first is not all that hard for anybody. You remember the case of Eve. She resisted at first in Genesis chapter 3. You remember when Satan came in the form of a serpent and tempted her to eat of the fruit that she said, no, we're not supposed to eat of that. Remember that? She resisted at first, but then she caved to the pressure. Samson resisted Delilah at first, didn't he? And he resisted again and he resisted again, but he finally caved to the pressure. And what I'm suggesting to you is there may be some young man, because of his principles and because of his faith, he says, no, I'm not interested. But if that pressure began to be put on day after day after day after day, the pressure begins to build. Here's what she did. Notice at verse 10. And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. Can you imagine being the young man in that circumstance where she's beginning to put pressure and she's making eyes and she's casting longing eyes and she's got her eyes targeting you? And consider your youth and consider your desires. And then on a daily basis, she begins to make passes. And on a daily basis, she says, here's how far I'm willing to go, if you're willing. You think of the pressure of that. Now let's look at Proverbs chapter 6 with me, if you will. And I want you to notice, from Satan's vantage point, the design of that is to wear him down. I remind you, Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, those three chapters, warn about the harlot, the strange woman. So in Proverbs 6 and in verse 26, for by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon this precious life. In other words, she, from Satan's point of view, this is designed to wear him down to the point he finally succumbs to the pressure. Oh, he may say no at first. He may say no again, and he may say no again. But finally, it's going to wear on him, and I'm wearing away the layer of that resistance, and finally he'll say yes. Oh, the temptation was strong, wasn't it? But that's not all. I want you to consider with me what made it strong was there's a convenient opportunity now. You realize that the fact that one could easily get caught serves as a deterrent to a crime or a sin, doesn't it? One who's tempted to steal, if he recognizes there's cameras around that are going to see that, or people are standing around who may see that, kind of deters the crime and the sin, doesn't it? But if you look around and think, nobody's going to see, nobody will ever know, I might easily take something that I didn't think I would take otherwise. The same is true with this case of adultery. Notice what she said. Look at verse 11, the master is gone. Go back to our text in Genesis 39, look at verse 11. And so it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work that none of the men of the house was inside. The master is gone. No one else is around. We won't get caught. Who will know? Who will see? All the people normally working in this house, they're gone. The master's not here. This is the time. Let's go to Proverbs 7 with me, if you will. I want to suggest to you, listen to this carefully, young folks. Please be advised that the proverb writer in warning about the strange woman, the harlot, how to avoid the sin of adultery, warns about the danger of being alone because it is so enticing. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 7, verses 19 and 20. This is the harlot. She runs out to meet the man in the street and tells him all kinds of lies about how you're the only one for me, she says. I came out diligently to seek your face, and I found you, verse 15. And here's what she says to him at verse 19, for my husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. Wait a minute, maybe he'll come in, he'll catch us. What if your husband comes home and he can't? Oh, no, he's not coming home. How do you know he's not coming home? Look at verse 20. He took a bag of money with him and he'll come home on an appointed day. He's gone on a business trip. He'll be gone for 2 weeks and he took a bag of money, took his traveler's checks with him. He's going to be gone a while. He's not coming back. We won't get caught. And may I suggest to you that there is a danger of being alone when no one else is around. There is danger, young people and parents. When those young people are in a parked car for long periods of time, there is a danger involved. There's a danger when they're in the apartment and no one else is around. When they're left at the house alone and no one else is around, there's a danger, there's a temptation involved. The harlot recognized that. So did Potiphar's wife recognize that. And what I'm tonight trying to paint picture for you is how strong that temptation was. And oh, it was strong. What makes you think it was strong? Well, you consider how young he was. And you consider that she was the one soliciting him. And she said, here's how far I'm willing to go. And she did this over and over and over. And finally now the opportunity is right. Would you want your son to be in that kind of circumstance? Would you want to be in that circumstance if you were Joseph? You think about his youth. She's putting pressure on him. She's saying how far she's willing to go. And finally, the time is right. But equal to the strength of that temptation, I want to suggest to you the resistance was firm. The temptation was strong, and the resistance was firm. Just as strong as the temptation was Joseph's resistance. So let's see what he did. How did he resist? Well, first of all, I want to suggest that he resisted with words. He had quite a bit to say. In fact, he had 5 things he said about it. Now remember, when she was seducing him, she didn't have to say anything. She did say some things. But she could say a lot with her eyes. She finally did say something. She said, come lie with me. But he resisted with words as well. What did he say? Well, here's the first thing he said. He said, no. He said, no. Look at Genesis 39 and in verse 8. Verse 8 said, but he refused. You know what that means? He said, no. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm not going to do that. Look at verse 10. And so it was, he spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. I wonder what's wrong with just saying no. Some of you are old enough to remember the day when, during the Reagan administration, Nancy Reagan had this campaign against drugs that said, just say no to drugs. And she caught a lot of flack over that because you can't just say no to drugs. You have to do more than say no. You just can't say no to drugs. And the question was raised, well, why not just say no to drugs? Why not just say no to any sin? Why not say no to drinking and drunkenness and fornication and adultery? He said, no, I'm not going to do it. But that's not all he said. Verse 8, he spoke of trust. He said, my master, trust me. Look at verse 8. He refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in a house and has committed all that he has into my hand. My master, trust me. Somebody put their trust in me. Your parents trust you to do the right thing. Your husband trusts you. Your wife trusts you to do the right thing. He spoke of trust. I'm not going to betray the trust your master, your husband has put in me. He trusts me to behave myself, and I'm not going to betray that. Thirdly, what did he say? He recalled the sacredness of marriage. Look at verse 9. There is no one greater in the house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. My master said I could have anything I wanted. I could touch anything I wanted. I could take anything I wanted, with the exception of you. Couldn't have you. Why not? Well, because you're his wife. He spoke of the sacredness of marriage. So I'm not going to do this. So you know my answer to it? My answer is no. My master trusts me, and you're a married woman. There's something sacred about marriage, but he's not through. Look at verse 9. He called it wickedness. He said at verse 9, how can I do this great wickedness? This is immoral. This is wicked. And he's still not through. He calls it a sin against God. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You see, Joseph recognized this is not just the fact that you're a married woman. It is not just that we may break up a marriage. It is not just that we'd be violating the marriage vows. It's not just that you would be untrue and unfaithful to your husband, but this is a sin against God. I want to tell you, when adultery is committed, while we have every right to focus on how bad it is in the marriage relationship and they're violating the marriage vows, while that's all true, the biggest problem is it is a sin against God. That's where the problem is. That's where the real problem is. And that's what Joseph said. Notice how he responded. Five things he said. He said, no, my master, trust me. You're a married woman. This would be immoral, and it's a sin against God, he said. He resisted with words. But that's not the only way he resisted. He resisted with deeds. There were two things he did with deeds. In other words, he put action to his words. Sometimes we'll say things, but then our actions say something different. You know, Joseph could have very well said, no, I'm not that kind of man. And yet he begins to spend more time with her and find every opportunity to be around her and feed off of the flirting that she's doing. That's not what he did. I want you to notice what he did. He refused to be with her. Here's something we sometimes miss at verse 10. And you might underline if you're so disposed to underline things in your Bible. And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her. That's not all the text says. Did you read the rest of it? Or to be with her. I think we sometimes read that text quite quickly that he refused to even to lie with her. Well, that's true. But that's not all it said. Are you reading the end of verse 10? Or to be with her. The New International translates that, or even be with her. The Living Bible translates that, kept out of her way as much as possible. You see what the text is saying? What the text is saying is he did everything he could to avoid the temptation. He understood the danger of association. He well understood that if he hangs around and hangs around, that could easily lead to a greater temptation and maybe succumbing to the sin. He recognized, this woman is a source of my temptation. And if I stay around her, then I might succumb to the temptation, so I don't even want to be around her. He understood the principle of Proverbs 5. Remember 5, 6, and 7, those three chapters? Chapter 5 says, do not go near the door of her house. You remember that? Don't go near the door of her house. In other words, don't go by there just to see if she's still there. Don't go by there to see if she'll still flirt. Don't go by there and see if she'll wink at you. Don't go by to see if she's found somebody else. Don't go by there just to see what's going on. Don't go near the door of her house. Joseph well understood that principle. There's a danger of association. There's a danger of hanging around. He refused to even be with her. He went as far from her as he could, but that's not all that he did. The second thing he did was he fled and he ran outside. You remember that part of the story, verse 12. Look at verse 12. And she caught him by the garment, saying, "Lie with me." He left his garment in her hand and he fled and he ran outside. Literally, he did that. That's not figurative. He didn't just think about that or in his mind he did that. He literally got up and he ran and he fled outside. He removed himself from the temptation. He put actions to his words. His action shows that his words were real. When he said no, he meant no. And when he said, "My master, trust me and I'll not betray that," he meant, "I will not betray that." When he said, "I recognize and respect the sacredness of marriage," he meant what he said. He shows that his words were real. And I want to suggest to you, young person, that means that you may have to leave a tempting circumstance. And you may laugh about what I'm about to say, but there's reality to this. And that is, you may find yourself in a tempting circumstance where you need to get out of the car and you just need to run for your life. You may need to get out of the apartment, you need to get out of the house, and you need to run, and you need to go and get away from the scene of temptation. Because I want to tell you, it'd be far less embarrassing to call somebody to come and get you on the street corner and to come home and tell mom and dad, "We have a child out of wedlock, and I hate to tell you, but we've been involved in sin." That's far more embarrassing. That's far more embarrassing. He fled and he ran outside. But that's not all. I want you to notice at verse 8 and verse 10 that he resisted promptly. You remember what he said at what the text said at verse 8? It said he refused. Verse 10 says, by day he resisted her. Verse 12 says he fled and he ran outside. That means he resisted without the slightest hesitation. It means without any dallying with the temptation. There was no waiting to see how far this may go. There is no indication that Joseph said, "You know, I don't think we ought to do this." But in the back of his mind, he's thinking, "You know, I'm wondering if she's serious about this. I'm going to play this out and just see if she's really willing to go that far." He resisted promptly. That's why he fled and he ran outside. He resisted firmly. I get all indication from verse 12 when the text says he refused. And he said, "This is great wickedness and sin against God, and that day by day he did not heed her," that he resisted firmly. There was no wavering. There was no indecision. There was no pushing aside something that he secretly desired to do, that "I really want to do this now, but I think I ought not to. I might get fired. I might lose my job." But when I say he resisted firmly, he said no, and he meant no. And he followed through with his actions. How did he resist? Oh, the temptation was strong, wasn't it? But likewise, the resistance was firm. He resisted with words. You remember the five words he said? He said, "No. My master, trust me. You're a married woman," he said. "This would be wicked and immoral, and this is a sin against God." He resisted with deeds. He refused to be with her, and he fled, and he ran outside. He resisted promptly, and he resisted firmly. The temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. And finally, I want to suggest to you the results are clear. Now, what do we mean the results are clear? When Joseph flees and he runs outside and finally settles down, he can look back, and he can see three things with greater clarity than he's ever seen before. I'm not saying Joseph had never seen any of this before, but I don't think he ever saw it with the clarity he's seeing it now. And so here are the results. When he gets outside, he can look back the place from which he had fled. And here's what he can see. Joseph can see this. He now sees the difference in love and lust. Joseph may have known that before, but if he didn't, he understands it now. What a difference there is in love and lust. This woman lusted for him. She did not love him. She lusted for him. She cast longing eyes after him. She said, come lie with me. Joseph could easily be misled and think, this woman loves me. He didn't. She didn't have any love for him. She lusted after him. Let me give you evidence of that. Remember her lies? Let's begin back at verse 14 now. You remember after that he resisted her and she had her garment in his hand and she suddenly comes up with this plan with the garment in her hand. She called the men of the house to her, that is the men that were around, and said, see, he has brought in this Hebrew to mock us. And I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened when I lifted up my voice that he cried out and left his garment and he fled and he went outside. You know what she's saying? Look here. Look what happened. This man came in and he tried to rape me. That's what she's saying. And if I hadn't screamed and hollered, he would have got away with it. And this man tried to rape me. Look at verse 17. When her master came in, the husband came in, when Potiphar came in, she said basically the same thing. She said, see, here is his garment. That man you brought in, that Hebrew, he came into Marcus. He tried to rape me is what he tried to do. She's lying through her teeth. She doesn't care a thing about Joseph. She didn't care a thing about him. She lies about him. She tried to destroy Joseph. And just a few moments before, she's saying, come lie with me. Pulpit accurately said, but indeed all illicit passion, whether gratified or balked, has a tendency sooner or later to be transformed into hate. I say amen. That is true. All illicit passion has a tendency to be transformed into hate. And it did in this case. And what I'm suggesting to you, young person, listen to me carefully, that one who lusts after you does not necessarily love you. That young man who says, if you love me, you will. We're committed in this relationship and we love each other. And if you really love me, you'll do this with me. He doesn't love you. He may say that, but he may not understand what love is. There's a difference in love and lust. When that young lady says, if you love me, you'll do this. She doesn't understand what love involves. Lust seeks gratification. Love cares about the person. I don't know how much of that Joseph understood before, but he can look back with greater clarity from which he had fled, and he can say, you know what? I now see the difference in love and lust. I would that all young people understood the difference in love and lust. Joseph now sees that with greater clarity than he's ever seen before. But I'll tell you something else he sees with greater clarity. And that is he looks back and he sees what he lost. If he had to flee and run outside, he didn't have time to gather things up. And he left some things inside that he can look back and think, you know what, I left some things. One of the most obvious things, he left his coat. Do you remember that? She left a garment in his hand. He don't have that anymore. That's not a big deal. Tell you something else he left in there. He can look back and think, you know what else? I left my job in there. He just lost his job is what he did. Evidence of that? Well, let's go get a little ahead of ourselves here. Let's go to Genesis 39, beginning at verse 19. We dropped off at verse 18. And so it was that when the master heard the words which his wife had spoken to him, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused, and Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, a place of the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. Now we'll finish the rest of that in a moment. He just lost his job. He just got fired. Not only did he lose his job, he just lost his freedom. Joseph, what are you thinking about as you look back? I'm thinking about the things I left inside that house. I left my garment in there. I left my job in there. And I left my freedom in there. He lost all of that. He lost his standing and his approval among men. Evidence? Do you remember the men of the house? They'd all revered Joseph. And here comes Potiphar's wife waving this garment. Look what this man tried to do to me. He tried to rape me. And now they all begin to believe he's a rapist. And she goes to her husband, the master, and says the same thing. Now he believes that. And now he's cast in prison. And all who knew Joseph, and there were many who did, now want to know what's going on with Joseph. He's off in prison on the charges of rape. He's lost his standing and his approval among men. He left that inside too. There's something else. And listen to me carefully. You may lose some things when you say no and you resist. When you tell your boyfriend or your girlfriend, you say, no, we're not going to do that. You may lose your boyfriend. He may threaten to walk away and said, we're done. You may lose your girlfriend. You may lose your standing among your peers. But Joseph lost some things too. You hadn't lost much if you lose a boyfriend over saying no. You hadn't lost much if you lose a girlfriend over saying no. You hadn't lost much. Joseph really didn't lose a whole lot by losing his friendship and his job and his freedom and his coat. When Joseph gets out on the outside, he can look back and there's something else he can see with greater clarity, and that is what he brought with him. We don't talk much about what he brought out. We talk about what he left in there. We talk about his coat. In the children's class, we talk about leaving his coat inside. He fled and he ran outside. But he had time to gather some things up and bring with him. What did he bring out with him? I want to tell you, he brought his purity with him. He could have easily left it in there. It would have been real easy to leave that in there. Because he's got a woman that's grabbing for him. Grabbing onto his clothes. Pulling him closer to her, saying, come lie with me. And this wasn't the first time that had happened. But he left his garment in her hand and he fled and ran outside and he took his purity out there with him. I'll tell you something else he took with him. He took his honor with him. Proverbs 6:33 talks about the one who succumbs to the harlot. Wounds and dishonor will he get. Remember David after he yielded to the sin with Bathsheba? That he said, my sin is ever before me. That's what he's talking about. That dishonor you carry over your head. He brought his honor out with him. I'll tell you something else he brought out with him. He brought his conscience with him. Joseph doesn't get outside and think, you know, what did I do? I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know what on earth now I'm going to do. My conscience is eating me up. He didn't have a thing to worry about now. He brought his conscience with him. And there's something else he brought out with him. His reputation among the godly. Now, I said he lost his standing among men. But he brought his reputation out among the godly. Evidence? We're talking about him tonight, aren't we? This isn't the first time you've heard a lesson about Joseph. Don't we talk about him in Bible class all the time? Don't we hold him up as a great example? He's got quite a reputation among the godly, I think. His reputation among the godly far outlived the dishonor he had among men. He kept his reputation among the godly. And I'll tell you something else he kept. His relationship with God. Now let's finish the chapter beginning at verse 21. He kept his relationship with God. He brought that out with him. But the Lord was with Joseph. Now remember, he'd just been cast into prison. The Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy. And he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were with him in prison. And whatever they did, it was his doing. And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper. He still had a relationship with God. He could have left it inside as well. When Joseph gets on the outside, he can look back with greater clarity. Now he sees there's a difference in love and lust. If I didn't understand it before, I understand it now. I left some things in there, all right. Maybe some important things, like my job and my freedom. But he brought some more important things out with him. His purity and his honor and his reputation among the godly. And his relationship with God. He brought every bit of that out with him. So what have we seen in our study tonight? We see the temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. And the results were clear. Now, I want you to listen carefully as I answer the question of why Do I deal with either this or some lesson very similar in nearly every meeting I go in? There was a survey made a number of years ago, and it's been so long ago I've lost my documentation of the survey, but I believe it was published in the Christian Chronicle a number of years ago. There was a survey made among the universities and institutions across the land, I mean all sorts of secular institutions, universities, about the percentage of the young people who are adult committing fornication. And I don't remember the numbers now, but it was significantly high. And so some of the people that were involved in the operation of the schools, and I put in quotations among brethren by that, like David Lipscomb and Fried Hardeman and Harding and so on down the line, all of those schools, Oklahoma Christian, decided to make a survey among those students in those so-called Christian schools on what the percentage was that were committing that same sin, and it was significantly lower. And so then the question was, why? So they interviewed the students and asked them, why do you not commit the sin of fornication? And the numbers were varied. I mean, the answers were varied. Some said there was fear of pregnancy. Some said they were fearful of venereal disease. Some said Bible class teachers had impacted them. Some said their parents had instilled it in them. Some said their peers did not put pressure on them and their peers lived pure. Number one answer was surprising. Pulpit preaching and teaching on the subject. And so everywhere I go, I try to deal with something along this line. For what purpose? There may be one person here tonight that may not remember 10 years from now who it was they heard to preach about Joseph. But if we can spare one soul, just one, from this study tonight, our time will be well spent. If just one person remembers about the temptation being strong and the resistance being firm, the difference in love and lust, and learning to say no and meaning no, then this whole meeting would have been worth it if we spare one soul, if that's all we do. And we may not know who that may be, and we may not know, and they may not remember the sermon. They may not remember whether it was at Westfield or who was it that preached it. That won't matter. But if we can spare one soul, our time is well spent. There may be one or more present tonight. He's not a Christian. He's not a child of God. Would you come tonight believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and while we sing?